Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mobile phones, they're with us everywhere we go. That means that what was once relegated to a phone booth is now out loud at the bus stop, the diner, the grocery store checkout. In fact, wherever there's a line, there's probably somebody reaching for a phone. And there's most likely someone else wishing they wouldn't. A new research poll suggests Americans don't always agree on mobile phone etiquette. Joining us now by phone is etiquette expert at the Emily Post Institute and author of Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online, Daniel Post Senning. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Listeners, let us know what your rules are for mobile phone etiquette. Join the conversation at 614-292-8513. Daniel, the Pew Research Center report found that mobile phone etiquette has a lot to do with where you are. On the sidewalk, it's okay, but in the movie theater, of course, or at a family dinner, generally not okay. Where do you draw the line?
Boy, so there are a couple things I like to think about when I think about when it's appropriate to use a cell phone, and one of them is the captive audience. We like to tell people, be really aware of the captive audience. So anywhere you're around other people and they can't get away, you really have to take extra care and take the responsibility for either minimizing your impact on them or just moving away or not taking that call at all. And that can be really difficult. Examples of captive audience, people who are sitting at a table eating a meal with you, people in at a religious service or in a theater with you. Maybe a public restroom is another place you might just have a hard limit and say, I'm not going to have my phone in my hand here.
Sometimes people just don't understand how loud they are on their phone.
Oh, tell me about it. People get lost in their own world. It's so easy to get drawn into these devices, and oftentimes what we're doing with them is so engaging. Sometimes we're maintaining some of our most important relationships. These are real social tools, and the danger is that we get drawn into that space and lose awareness about where we are and what we're doing. It's that where we are question that they bring up in the study, but also the what we're doing question. If you're in a social context, if you're interacting with other people, this study really pointed out that it's perceived as rude to take your attention away from that group, away from that social interaction, to interact on your device.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about mobile device etiquette right now. My guest is Daniel Post Senning. He's etiquette expert at Emily Post Institute and author of the book Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. If you have a strong feeling about mobile phone etiquette, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Daniel, you must get a lot of calls because it seems like this issue is right up there with pet peeves and grammar.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the biggest issues in etiquette today. My great-great-grandmother wrote her first book about etiquette in 1922, and some things in that book are the same today as they were in 1922. The way she would tell you to eat with a knife and fork are very similar to the ways that I would say you should eat with a knife and fork. If you look at her communication manners, they're almost entirely gone. Communication manners change all the time, and there's no question the cell phone, the smartphone, is the biggest, most recent change in that communication environment. And this study really points to how ubiquitous the cell phone and the smartphone are today, that something like 90% of people are carrying these devices, and the vast majority of those people are carrying them frequently or often. And that means that they're around us all the time, and they're important tools for our social interactions, but they're also something that we have to be aware of almost all of the time now.
Yeah, because for a lot of people, that's the only phone they have.
It really is, and boy, I tell you, just yesterday I spent all day editing a video that's an etiquette instructional video about how to manage your personal cell phone at work, because that's a particularly tricky place. It used to be that all phone calls came through an office phone system, and most offices had no personal calls policies. And now each individual is asked to regulate their own social interaction, their personal, not work interaction. And parents carry phones because they want to stay in touch with their kids. But how many parents have really had a meaningful discussion with their children about what constitutes an emergency that's worth calling over? And it's a relatively large number, but it's not everybody. And that's an important conversation to be having for working parents, for example.
It's no surprise that younger people have different ideas about what's appropriate for mobile phone use than older people. There's the digital native, and then there's the rest of us, right? Etiquette changes over time. It's had to adapt to technology.
It sure does, and it sure has. And this generational awareness is an important part of good communication and good communication etiquette. And there's no question about that. This particular study drew a line for people 29 and under. They're much more forgiving for their peers using mobile devices in social environments, for example, although some things are remarkably consistent across generations. No matter what age someone is, the tendency that they're going to view the more intimate social settings as places where they shouldn't be on their phone or they should be more careful with their phone use is consistent across all ages. So whether you're a grandparent or whether you're spending time with your grandparents, most people understand that when they're in public situations, they can use their phone. But as that situation gets more private, more intimate, more personal, you need to be more careful.
What is the proper etiquette for using a phone on a date or hanging out with friends? So the phone rings. What do you do if you're on a date versus just out with your friends?
Oh, boy. So when you ask a question about a date, that's one of those times I really warn people. I like to advise ahead of time, do yourself a favor, give yourself a chance, and do your best not to have that phone in your hand. Really keep your attention on the person you're with. It really means something in today's world to give that kind of time and attention to someone. So it sends a message right off the bat. The broader question, though, of how do you do that well? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Warn people ahead of time if you're expecting a call.
Mm-hmm.
The other biggie is let people know what you're doing. And it's really perceived differently whether you bring your attention to a mobile device to do something that's supportive of what the group is doing or whether you're doing something that takes your attention away and elsewhere. And this is a new courtesy that's emerging. But the idea that if you're all together and you take a picture of the group or for the group that you're sharing or you're looking up something that's of interest to the group, that's one use that's generally viewed as not just acceptable, it's becoming common and appropriate.
Like, get out your Googler, we have a question.
Exactly. Yeah. How are we going to get to where we're going? Have mm-hmm. we heard from the restaurant yet that our table's available? These are all essential social functions, and our phones are part of that. On the flip side, if you're distracted, if your attention goes from one conversation to something else, if your attention is being drawn away, then that's something you really want to be careful of because that is perceived as rude.
And what about people who are texting each other while they're in a group?
the Pavlov's dogs phenomenon of you just use your phone habitually, mm-hmm. even though mm-hmm. the person's right there next to you.
Right.
The importance of cultivating face-to-face human interaction skills can't be overstated. There is an emerging body of research about how important it is to practice interacting with people in person. It really cultivates the quality of empathy and the skill of empathy. Face-to-face interactions are important to our social development, and they're important to our health as humans. So I don't have a larger comment on two people texting within a group, but I personally like to encourage people to be careful about how often you turn to that phone. If you have the opportunity to interact with someone in person, really seize it, because there's a lot of rewards to be reaped there.
You know, there is this so-called back channel. Say you're in an audience, you're texting your friends, or you're tweeting about something, and everyone in your immediate group is getting a kick out of it, but the rest of the audience isn't necessarily.
Yeah, the one of the great things about new technology and new communication is that the same etiquettes that have served us well for 100 years continue to apply in these new situations and environments. The core principles of consideration, respect, and honesty continue to apply and are particularly useful when we don't know a current manner or rule. So when you pose a situation like that to me, I think to myself, well, how is it being done? Is it being deceptive? Is it being done in a way that hurts somebody? Is it snide or snickering? Is it deceptive in some way? And if it's not, it might be entirely appropriate. But you really want to be careful about how you're using that device, and you want to be sure that you're considerate, that you're being respectful of all the people that you're with, and that ultimately you're operating from a place of sincerity, honesty, and integrity.
Right, because those mobile devices, as we've, you know, obviously everybody knows this, but they're not just phones now.
No, absolutely. They're incredibly powerful tools. I think someone was telling me recently, the computers they used to send men to the moon in the 1970s were not as powerful as the computers we carry around in our pocket every day. The range of things you can do on these devices is remarkable. My cousin Anna is a great etiquette teacher. She'll often take her phone and hold it up. She'll say, "This is my phone. It's amazing. I love it. It's not rude. It's not polite. It's how I use it that matters." So whatever it can do, whatever power it wields, it really is up to you as the user to be in control of that device.
You know, one thing that I think people are confused about is when they're in a meeting. So they're at work. They're in a meeting for work. It's professional. Hey, yep. my phone is a professional tool that I use. I'm checking my emails while I'm in this meeting. I'm checking texts. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. What about meetings?
This was one of the areas of the study that surprised me and pleasantly surprised me. I've seen a lot of studies about where cell phone use and smartphone use is perceived as rude, mm-hmm. and almost always the dinner table or religious services or theaters is at the top of the list. In this particular study, it was meetings, and I think that's important to be aware of. People rely on their devices to get through the workday. That's a really important reality for many people. But it's also true that because these phones are so intrusive and they're everywhere, that people's awareness of them in meetings is maybe even growing as they become a larger and larger distraction. I advise people who are organizing meetings to let people know ahead of time what the policy is about use of device in the meetings. It's important for the meeting organizer to say, you know, it's all right to use your meetings to check or to use your devices to take notes, but I would like everybody to keep their attention here in the room and not check emails during today's meeting. And then you also tell people when your breaks are going to occur so they know that they can be responsible to the people they need to be responsible to in an age where the frequency of our communication is greater and greater than it's been before. So it's up to organizers to set standards. It's up to participants to observe them. Talk about it ahead of time. It's going to save you a world of difficulty later on when people perceive something you're doing as rude, whether it is or isn't.
You know, I have noticed a lot fewer ringtones.
It's funny. It's true. But because these devices are on all the time, the likelihood that someone carries a device and that it's on everywhere that they carry it is going up. I also think that because of that, we've learned to silence them and mm-hmm. to even be careful of the vibrate function. I like to warn people, don't leave your phone behind you at the desk, even if it's on vibrate. If it's sitting in the drawer, how many people have walked past a vibrating desk?
Mm-hmm.
You just hear it rumbling away there. So I think people are learning to silence these devices, particularly when they're places where a captive audience might not be able to get away.
See, I have mine silenced all the time, which drives some people crazy because I never answer my phone.
Hard time reaching you.
Yeah,
it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, but I check it often so to see if I've missed a call, and I'll call right back.
I'll confess I use my device the exact same way.
Yeah, I mean, because I can't stand the sound of the ringtones. They're all irritating and stupid to me.
And I think it's also important how we set up expectations with the people that we communicate with on these devices. That is it realistic for someone to expect a 30 to 40 second turnaround on every text that they send you? Probably not. And I definitely think it's important for people to manage their social expectations through the device, as well as stay aware of how they use the device around other people.
Well, I want to thank you, as always, Daniel Posenning, for dropping in and talking about a little bit of etiquette with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Daniel Posenning, he's an etiquette expert at Emily Post Institute. He's also the author of the book Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. From kindergarten to high school and beyond, students and teachers are taking advantage of technology and educational software, right in the classroom. But that trend also exposes more student data as it is collected and shared. And many state governments are considering tighter safeguards of student data. Joining us now by phone is New York Times reporter Natasha Singer. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again, Anne.
You just wrote about this just a couple days ago. Tools for tailored learning may expose students' personal details was the headline. Can you give us an idea of some of the ways that technology is being incorporated into schools in a way that is exposing data?
Yes. Certainly, many more kinds of data is being collected about students and used in new ways. I think one of the major questions is it a risk or not? And that's what legislatures in nearly every state are trying to contend with. So, for example, there are many schools are using learning apps, which are math or language arts apps that collect information on students in real time and try to personalize their lessons. So they're going to collect every time a student clicks something or writes something or every time they hesitate. You know, the math app will see how long they're hesitating and what they're hesitating over and then, you know, show them the next problem based on, you know, not only what they got right or wrong, but how long it took them to answer the question. And many of these tools we certainly would like to have in the classroom, and we hope that they will improve learning. The question for parents is, you know, what kind of conclusions are these apps drawing? And are they making assumptions, or are there algorithms making decisions that might negatively affect kids? And we're not just talking about the learning tools, but we're talking about everything becoming digitized. So cafeteria purchases, there are some schools that use biometric scans, and so students, you know, we all have unique veins in our hands, and so students enroll their hands instead of like cash, and when they go to the cafeteria, they swipe their hand at the cash register and take their food. So their biometric information is associated with their food purchases, and parents are concerned about where's that information going. Or their apps for high school or junior high sports team coaches, and parents are entering all their kids' health information into those apps, and the apps also have information on where every game is. And so then there are questions about, okay, where's my kid's health data going? And is that protected? Because we have medical privacy laws, but they pertain to doctors and insurers, not coaches and apps. And so I think it's the magnitude, the exponential increase in data collection about students that's of concern. And I also think that it's not just the learning tools, but schools themselves are collecting more information about students' behavior and their social economic status and how many times did your nursery school student cry this week. And so some parents are concerned about what schools are doing with that information, not just the technology companies that are making digital tools for the classroom.
Aren't schools automatically not allowed to share data of students?
There is a 40-year-old federal education privacy law, and it requires schools to obtain consent for sharing certain information in the educational record with other parties. But there are exceptions to that rule, and one is there's a list of information that includes students' name and age and what sports teams or theater groups they're in and what grade they're in and their address and phone number that can be shared under this exception. And some marketers go to schools and they can get the information directly from schools. And I found one company that's actually selling this high school students' email mailing list and addresses. I just want to read you two sentences from it because it stood out to me. So this is what one company is selling of high school student information. This file is composed of jocks, nerds, cheerleaders, goths, and different cliques in between. These puberty-infested students are looking for a sense of belonging, making them perfect prospects for offers on trendy clothing, used cars, music downloads, and more. So that's the kind of information that can be shared and that marketers can obtain and can use.
And they are. So who's actually seeing this when they're marketing that in that way? Who's the customer?
The customer can be all kinds of brands that are trying to market to students, mm-hmm. whether that's shoes or like college loans. Or like, you know, some parents have called me upset because their kids were sent letters that sounded like they'd won these big prizes. You know, you've won this big academic honor. All your parents have to do is pay $500 for you to attend this weekend. You know, and the parents looked into it, and, you know, it came from school-based data, but the child hadn't won anything. It was a scheme to get the parents to pay money. And so there's all kinds of concerns about where this information is going.
Where in the world do lawmakers start when it comes to regulating how this data is collected and meted out?
It's an incredible phenomenon right now that we're seeing, because 2 years ago, just one state, Oklahoma, introduced and passed a law about student data collection. And this year, nearly every state, 46 states, introduced 182 bills. And 15 of those states passed 28 laws that have to do with regulating the use or collection of student data. And one of the trends we're seeing is, it started with California last year that put into place a law that prohibits education technology companies, so online services that design their products for schools and do business with schools that are K through 12, from using students' data for marketing purposes or purposes that aren't the school purpose. And so what those, and so this year, you know, about 25 states introduced similar laws with this marketing prohibition. And that gets the low-hanging fruit off the table, mm-hmm. right? That gets off, you know, if my son or daughter writes a report about baseball cards or flower arranging or who knows what, they're not going to be shown ads or get marketing material for baseball cards and flower arranging. But when parents call me, and they do, and they're upset about things, they're actually, you know, parents don't call me and say, I'm worried my kid's information is going to be used to market to them. They call me and say, my school weighed my daughter and sent home a letter saying that she was at risk for obesity. And, you know, my daughter was, you know, in fourth grade, and she was already having body image issues, and I've taken her to the pediatrician who says she doesn't, you know, she's not at risk for obesity, and this letter was handed out to my daughter in front of the class. And a study recently has shown that these kind of obesity intervention programs where schools weigh kids and take their height and figure out their body mass index and send letters home to kids that are in the obesity range actually has no positive effect. 2 years later, the kids who were part of these programs didn't weigh less or have any significant change compared to the kids who weren't weighed and didn't get these fat letters. So this is an issue where it's the school collecting the data mm-hmm. with really good intent, right? They want to try to tackle obesity. But in fact, the data collection, you know, the surveillance is harmful in itself. Like the moms who called me said, the kids were weighed in public in front of each other. Their weight was yelled out. They made fun of each other. And some of the people doing the weighing were volunteer parents, not even nurses. So they were worried about whether the data was protected. And then, you know, having handed out these letters in front of the class, like, it doesn't do any good. And so this is, like, not to do with education vendors, not to do with marketers. This is the school. And so one of the things that legislators are grappling with is, should we restrict the collection of data by schools? And it was really interesting because Maine passed a really narrow law this year forbidding student assessments that either collect or share information about students' attitudes, values, motivations, stereotypes, and feelings. You know, so Maine decided that that's none of the business of schools when they're doing assessments, is to, like, get into this emotional arena. But on the other hand, for companies that are trying to build products for schools, if every state passes their own law and every state defines the personal data of students differently and every state puts into different, you know, different rules what can and can't be done, it's going to be a problem for the companies that are trying to make innovative tools to try to make learning better. And so the question is, you know, can there be a federal law that deals with some of this that we can all agree on?
My guest is Natasha Singer. We're talking about learning tools that could expose student data in ways that is objectionable to parents or is unethical. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Natasha, doesn't it all boil down to the fact of if educational evaluation company, you know, companies, testing companies, they're collecting that data. Isn't the problem from a parent's perspective when the data is connected to an identifying factor of their child, the social security number, student ID number, that kind of a thing? I mean, ultimately collecting data in and of itself to learn more about how your testing's coming across and how people are responding to it in and of itself isn't bad. It's connecting it to individuals, right?
But this is identifiable data. So this is information about individual students, their names, their addresses,
right.
their email addresses. And along with that is
how they feel about stuff and
how they feel about, whatever. I mean,
what
their political affiliations may be, or what their religious feelings are.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, some states are really curbing those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Georgia passed a really comprehensive law this year that in part barred education technology companies from using students' data for marketing, but it also barred schools from sharing information like students' criminal or juvenile delinquency records, or their medical or health information, or their political affiliation or voting history with the state. And so I think that the concern is that this is identifiable by student, but it's not just the question of sharing it. It's the question of if decisions are being made about my child, is somebody going to connect the fact that we have a single parent family and we have low income and my child is eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And if this math app says that they're not doing well and connects that to those social economic factors,
mm-hmm.
is my child going to be channeled into a program that somehow is going to segment them off and limit their opportunities? I think that's the fundamental fear. It's not about outside parties. It's about what is the school going to do with this data that might affect my student, my child's career opportunities or higher education possibilities, or even within the school system, segment them off in some way that's not helpful. And the education technology companies would tell you the complete opposite, that the point of gathering all this data is to figure out how to help children
mm-hmm.
who are at risk, not to further segment them in ways that are detrimental. But I guess when I hear from parents, one of the questions is, where is all this information going and why is it being collected? Shouldn't there be studies first? Why not study obesity in schools and see if tracking kids and weighing them and sending letters home is going to have a positive effect before, making this something that schools are doing in 25 states?
We know because of data collection that low-wealth districts, which are generally measured by how many kids are on the free lunch program, right, generally can be low-performing academically. We know that. I mean, why does connecting it – what people are worried about is personalizing that data and having individuals affected by it.
Yes.
And we don't have enough evidence out there, because no one's ever really studied it, about what impact this kind of data collection and usage could have. It's just being done.
And so one of the interesting things we're seeing is different groups across the country at universities and other research centers doing studies
uh-huh.
and saying, let's prove that this works, and then it can be rolled out to lots of schools. So there are pockets of people studying efficacy. And I think that this is going to be the new trend. Even the Department of Education came out with a guide for ed tech software developers saying, folks, you startups, you actually have to test this, and you have to make sure it works before you put it in schools. And they have this whole 80-page guide, and now they're going to sort of shepherd some pilot studies in schools to figure out optimum ways of deciding, because if you think about with drugs, pharmaceutical companies do huge clinical trials
mm-hmm.
where they test a novel medicine on a group, and then there's another group that gets a placebo. And, can you do that in education where it's not just the product, like a pill, right? It's how the teacher uses it in the classroom. It's much more complicated to test.
You, 46 states have introduced legislation. Is it that much of a hodgepodge? Aren't there best practices out there that states are kind of glomming onto?
These bills fall into different categories. And a couple dozen, as I said, are in the category of ed tech companies that do business with schools should not use students' data for marketing purposes. But some of the bills are about regulating schools. The Georgia bill says that the Department of Education should create a chief privacy officer and should also create a data inventory, so like a public data dictionary that parents can look at about the kinds of information being collected about students and stored in the state data system. Other states are looking at you know, how should we study all this data collection before we make rules? So I think you're seeing a wide, and some of it has to do with anxiety about testing, and, you know, we shouldn't adopt tests that do X and Y. So I think that you're seeing a huge variety of different efforts by legislators in various states to contend with this problem that's so new, right? And they're also trying to balance the possible benefits of these innovations in schools with these risks that, you know, some of which are hypothetical.
So is there anything being done at the federal level to temper all this monkeying around at the state level?
Yes. Earlier this year, President Obama gave a speech at the Federal Trade Commission in which he said student data should only be used for educational purposes, and we're going to pass a law to that effect. And now there are five different efforts in Congress that have to do with improving protections for students. One is a bill that says ed tech companies, you can only use student data for school purposes. And there are other efforts to try to reform that 40-year-old federal education privacy law we talked about earlier and try to bring it up to date, you know, because it was designed in the era of file cabinets and it didn't predict all this wholesale data collection.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, when I talk to tech people and they say, oh, this change could be a long way off. And I say, now I'm smart. I say, oh, you mean like a week? And they're like, yeah. You know, everything's happening very quickly. Lawmakers don't tend to act that quickly on issues like this.
I think that is true, and we are seeing some trade groups in Washington that represent online companies send their comments to Congress saying, you know, for example, one of the bills to do with education data has data breach notification. You know, that says vendors, you're going to have to notify parents if there's a security problem with the data. And some of the trade groups have said those are too vague or too onerous. Or the advertising restrictions are too strict. And so there is going to be a back and forth. But I just think that the good thing is that there is suddenly this massive dialogue going on in Congress and in nearly every state in the country, so that there is recognition that these tools have potentially positive effects, but there's also recognition that we haven't had student surveillance of this magnitude ever, and parents' concerns that, like, their kids' data could be used in unforeseen ways is legitimate.
And we're talking about this data. Are you just talking about K through 12, or are you also talking about higher ed?
So this is also happening in higher ed, but a lot of these state bills pertain to K through 12. So universities are also using all kinds of online systems that track students, and the massive open online courses, the MOOCs, also do a lot of data collection and analysis. And the federal law pertains to students in publicly funded institutions, so it also covers college students. And at that point, you know, there's some rules that say parents are entitled to get a copy of the student's record. Well, if the student is over 18, the student has the right to get a copy of their record.
Okay. Well, Natasha Singer, I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks again for having me.
It's Natasha Singer. She's a reporter for the New York Times. We'll have a link to her article entitled Tools for Tailored Learning May Expose Students' Personal Details in the New York Times. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time to have a little bit of fun with that etiquette issue, cell phone etiquette issue. What are your pet peeves? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@allsides.com. at WOSU.org. Some of the pet peeves when someone's talking in a restaurant, on the street, at the movies, in a car, on a train or a bus. What do you think the rules ought to be? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. My pet peeve is when people are talking loudly into a phone. It doesn't matter where we're at, if it's in a public place and they're talking very loudly. And, you know, you really don't want to say anything because usually they just don't realize they're doing it. But I don't really care about the plan somebody's making to have dinner that night or, you know, what they saw at the movie theater today or what they're waiting in line for today. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't like listening to people's phone conversations. I definitely miss private phone booths. Give us a call. Tell us what your pet peeves are. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. I have people standing by to do that. And you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides too. What's your pet peeve? We have a little time here today. Let's talk. 614-292-8513. And Jules in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great. My pet peeve is when people post that I am with them at a certain place, and sometimes you don't find out until later that you've been tagged in a post and you're at said restaurant, bar, wherever, and they've tagged you whether they've gone to the bathroom and done it or they've done it under the table, and all that says to me is, your house is empty. Please go and rob me.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. I just don't like it in general. I don't post where I'm at in any given time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And some people really get into that, but I've noticed less and less. That's a really very important point. Thanks for calling, Jules.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
614-292-8513 is the number to call with your pet peeves on mobile devices. Dawn in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Dawn.
Yes. Hi. My pet peeve is when people are wearing Bluetooth headsets and you don't realize it. It looks like they're talking right to you and you're trying to figure out what is it that you're talking to me about, but they're not talking to you at all.
It is. It's very confusing and they look weird too. I'm just saying.
I mean,
I'm probably going to get it.
Right. It's great for if you're having a little conversation with yourself and don't want to look out of place, but yeah, it's frustrating in the supermarket.
All right. Thanks a lot,
Thanks.
Don. Bye-bye. 614-292-8513. Give us your pet peeves. Let's have some fun. Oh, here's a good one. Dave in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
All right. No, I don't even want to go into the safety aspect of this pet peeve, right?
Yeah.
But it's pretty obvious when you hear, you're at the red light and the person in front of you is texting away like they're in their living room and the light turns green. And they keep on texting. Just hang up already. I got places to be.
Yeah.
And then they always look surprised when someone behind them honks at them.
Right.
They're the rude person.
Well, you know the thing with texting, though, with all of that is, all right, so you got a light. And it's a long light. You do it every morning and you're going to start it. You can always put the phone down and finish the text when you're done.
There's a little button that you can talk to your phone and it'll text
you. Well, there's that, too. There's that,
too. So, you know, I'm not even going to be the purist and say I never do it. But good Lord, if it's 30 seconds and you're still doing it, something's wrong.
Yeah. You're a slow texter anyway. Exactly.
Right.
All right, Dave. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Bye-bye. 614-292-8513. Nicole in Lewis Center, what's your pet peeve?
My pet peeve is when you're in like a crowded mall or like on the sidewalk and there's a lot of people outside and the person in front of you is texting and he's either just stops walking completely unaware that there are people behind them.
Yeah.
Or walks incredibly slow and they can't keep their head up because they're on their phone the whole time.
Right. Right. And that's really tough. I've heard in super busy downtown areas like New York and Chicago, when there really is a train going down that sidewalk and it's called human beings and somebody stops suddenly and they can have problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Now, do you text while you're walking?
I don't. I really don't. I try to keep it in my back pocket unless, you know, I keep it on. And if I get a call or a text, I can, you know, it's important or whatever. But no, I definitely do not do that because it infuriates me.
Right. All right, Nicole. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
614-292-8513. I think, Kendra in Columbus, we can just reiterate this one. What's your pet peeve?
When people, I guess, don't invest in the headphones with the microphone. And so all they have is the headphone, but then they hold the phone up to their mouth and they're speaking pretty loudly where everybody can hear them speaking to their friends.
Yes. Yes.
I just please pay the extra $5 and get a mic. Because if I can't hear the responses, I don't want to hear your comments.
Well, the other thing is you don't have to be yelling anyway. I mean,
right.
You know, the whole point is you don't have to be yelling, but people just, it's like you're talking to a deaf person and people think you need to, if you talk louder, they'll hear you better, and they don't. It doesn't have anything to do with it.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, sometimes when people are on the air, you've probably heard when they have their phone too close to their mouth, it creates a static. It's very difficult to understand people then.
Yes.
Okay, Kendra, thanks a lot for that call.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Oops. Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I was calling. Actually, I thought of another one while I was waiting in line. But my first pet peeve is the waiting in line at the post office or the grocery store, and the person who's in front of you who's checking out is talking on the phone while they're also talking to the person who's checking them out.
Yeah.
And, you know, so somebody will, they'll be saying, you know, wanting to finish the transaction, but they're busy talking to somebody else and making everybody in line wait for them. And then two, not treating the person, you know, that's checking them out with the respect that they're due, and trying to help them leave the store in the first place.
You know, that happened to me once, Sean, when I was in that situation and the line moved faster than I thought it would be. And I already don't like to talk in lines, but I got right up to the person checking out and I felt terrible about it. I felt terrible.
Yeah. The other one is when you're at a mall or an open place and people walk around. One of your other callers mentioned the headsets.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes people will walk around and you can't tell that they have a headset on.
Yeah.
And they may be standing and looking right at you and speaking to you. Right. And they're talking, and you have no idea that they're talking to someone else. You look at them and you say, are you talking to me? And then they're angry because you interrupted their phone call.
Right. I could visualize the whole thing. Actually, the other caller had the exact same description. Who are you talking to? Why are you talking to me? I don't know you. It's very distracting, and they don't realize they're doing it. But a lot of people talk with their Bluetooths all the time now. So, all right, Sean.
Well, I'm hanging up, turning mine off.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Oh, Nicole in Dublin. Hi.
Hi.
What's your pet peeve?
My pet peeve is when I receive a call from someone on their cell phone and then they interrupt their conversation because they're at a drive-thru and now they got to order, and then they don't let it be Starbucks because then is it what size is that? So I've got to go wait on them to get through all that. Or worse, you realize they're in a public bathroom or even their own bathroom. It's like, you were so bored, you were so lonely that you couldn't wait till you were done to give me a call. Really?
And then you hear the toilet flush, right?
I didn't need all that.
Yeah, too much information.
Yeah, but truly, when someone calls you, starts a conversation, and then stops you mid-thought because they've got to order a coffee or a sandwich or something, and you have to sit there and listen like you weren't busy doing something else.
Right. Oh, that is funny. Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you.
See ya. Email from Caleb in Old North Columbus. I don't care how much you paid for your phone. Those little teeny speakers sound terrible. Please don't play your favorite band for me. It sounds like sand in a tin can. This is a classic. Patty and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Mike. Pet peeve is when people are using their cell phone during the movie, whether they're texting or looking something up on Google, and then I ask them to please turn their cell phone off And then people around me get mad because I'm talking during the movie.
Right, right, right. You can't win, right? You can't win for
Liz.
That's
right.
All right, Patty. That's irritating to me, too. I give them the evil eye first, and maybe I don't have to say anything. And hopefully if I do say something, they don't recognize my voice, right? Patty, thanks a lot for that call. Take care. Let's see. Sherelle in Columbus. Hi, Sherelle.
Hi, Anne. I'm a huge fan. Love you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, my pet peeve is when business professionals, like say someone I'm interviewing with,
yeah.
or one time I saw a professional trainer and I wanted to seek out his business, he kept pulling out his phone during our consultation. And I'm like, don't you value our time? Don't you want my business? Like, do you deem me important enough? Like, I understand you're a busy person, but come on, like 5-10 minutes to take the time out just to hear me out. So that's one of my biggest pet peeves.
I agree. That's incredibly
yeah.
rude when you're having
yeah.
a meeting with someone. And that's mm-hmm. not even in a group meeting. You're talking about one-on-one, right?
Yes,
yeah.
one-on-one. Mm. I've had that happen numerous times. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm really busy. But like,
yeah, no, that's tacky.
You can call them back.
Yeah, that's not busy. That's tacky.
Yeah.
All right, Sherelle. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, Georgia and Columbus. We have to reiterate this one, don't we?
Oh, the cell phones in public bathrooms?
Yes.
Well, I kind of lost it one day at Kroger's bathroom. Ladies yakking away, and there's people piling up waiting to use the bathroom. And I mean, if you follow what I mean, she kept doing it long after she could have been out of the
right.
phone. And finally, from the door to the hallway, I had to yell, hey, lady, this is a bathroom, not a frickin' phone booth.
Right. Right.
And the place just cracked up, and she came out and hustled right by me. And I was thinking, man, I hope I don't see that broad in the parking lot.
Exactly. But no, but you know what? It does say something about phone booths. I mean, there used to be more value to them than just having a phone on a hook. It was privacy.
Right, right.
We take that for granted. Well, Georgia, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Harrison and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Harrison.
Hey, I my peeve is when you're at a concert and everyone's in the front in the pit is sitting there holding their cell phones up
yeah.
recording as opposed to actually enjoying the concert. And what started to happen now even worse is people doing the same thing with iPads. It's just awful.
It's bad enough that they're standing up blocking the view. Now they're sticking their phones up and their iPads in the air.
It's just like, you know, be here with us in this moment. You'll remember it. You don't need a video and... It just drives me crazy.
Yeah. All right, Harrison, that's a really good point, everybody. So if you're lucky enough to sit up in the front, then let the rest of the people behind you be able to see it. Thanks a lot, Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Ryan, I think you're just kind of you're exaggerating, aren't you, Ryan?
Who, me?
Yeah.
About being called? No, not at all. I can't understand why people call me. Like, what is this archaic thing that you're doing right now? You've got, like, half a dozen asynchronous ways to get a hold of me. You can text me, you can Facebook message me, you can Snapchat, you can Kick. And
yeah.
you're calling, like you're assuming that I can just drop what I'm doing to deal with you. You know who else calls me? My grandma calls me. Like, after you get off this call, are you going to like hop on your horseless carriage and go down to Blockbuster and rent a moving picture? You know what I mean?
But your grandma can call you, can't she?
Yes,
okay.
yes, but
All
it's
right.
like there's this kind of thing where it's like, I'm sorry, if you're in your 20s and 30s or even 40s, like, don't be on the same tier of communication as my grandmother, you
okay.
know what I mean?
Yeah. I do know what you mean, Ryan. That's a very interesting point of view. I appreciate it, and I will never call you.
All right. Thanks.
All right, but thanks for calling today.
Yeah.
All right. I got time for one more call, and I'm going to go with Donna in Columbus. You hate it from the other point of view.
Yes, ma'am. When your parents entrust you with a cell phone or a mobile device of any sort, when they call you or text you, there is a reason. Please, for the love of Pete, answer the phone call.
Or text back. I'm with
yes.
you, Donna. I'm with you. So you got my vote.
You know, Donna, I need to know where you are. Where are you alive? Are you dead?
Right.
Answer me.
Right. Just a text is all I ask for. All right, Donna. Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate
Have
it.
Have a good afternoon.
And right. thanks to everybody who called today. I really enjoyed talking with you. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.